Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. It's Monday the 15th of May. You're listening to Kildare's KFM. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to John Lannan, CEO of Durris. He says the government's failure to provide accommodation is putting migrants' lives at risk. Then we'll speak to Rhaida Cronin, Sinn Féin TD for Kildare North. Kildare rents have soared by over 11% in the last year. We'll speak to Alva McCurry. She's a PhD researcher in marine biotechnology at UCD. Scientists are discovering the incredible health properties of Irish seaweeds to make medicines to combat dangerous superbugs. And then last, we'll speak to Simon McGrath, head of communications at the Camping and Caravanning Club. People who go camping are happier and more relaxed than those who don't. That's according to new research. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can call in on 045 898 999. You can email me on studio@kfmradio.com, or you can send me a WhatsApp or a text to 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, according to Durris, the government's failure to provide accommodation is putting migrants' lives at risk. And as we heard over the weekend, the camp outside the International Protection Office in Dublin was subject to attacks and horrible things happening. I'm joined now on the line by John Lannan. He is CEO of Durris. Good afternoon, John. Shocking scenes over the weekend, John.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just horrific that things got to the point that they did, and that there are people here in this country who would organise others to go out and not just incite, but act on violently against others. You know, we'd all have to condemn in the strongest possible terms those violent racist attacks. They don't represent the vast majority of Irish people. We know that communities the length and breadth of Ireland have welcomed not just beneficiaries of temporary protection from Ukraine, but also international protection applicants. They've provided them with clothes, they've provided with other essential items as it was needed. And of course, we always have to remember that Irish people have for generations sought better lives abroad, been welcomed in America and Australia and everywhere else. So we have a moral as well as a legal obligation to show the same welcome now to people who are escaping from war and persecution and oppression.
Absolutely, John. Just for people maybe who may have missed it over the weekend or weren't tuned in, just give us a flavour of the events that happened over the weekend in Dublin.
So the background to it is that over the last few months, the Irish government, and specifically the Department of Children, were tasked with providing emergency accommodation for international protection applicants have been failing to do so for all of the people who were arriving in the country. So there were close to 600 people who have sought asylum here who are street homeless. They have no place to go. And they were residing in very temporary dwellings in tents off Mount Street, where the International Protection Office is. Now, they've been subject to abuse for weeks, but on the weekend, on Friday night, an organised attack was perpetrated against them, resulting in some of their possessions and some of the camp being put on fire, which is essentially endangering their lives. These are vulnerable people who've already experienced displacement. They've been traumatised, and they faced that on Friday night. Now, it was good to see that there were people who came to their support, to their defence. They tried to block the attacks that were being perpetrated and organised against them. And that ensued for a while when the Gardaí had to arrive to respond to the situation.
John, for the people now who maybe their tents were burned, or, you know, their possessions were stolen or anything like that, like, what are they going to do now? You know, obviously they're fleeing terrible situations as it is. And now they've been left, let down by the government here. But where do they go from here?
They certainly have been let down by the government, but it's welcome to hear today that the government have said that emergency accommodation will be provided for most, they say, of the 500 asylum seekers who are currently without a place to live. Now, we hope it's all of the asylum seekers who have been left homeless, and we hope it happens very, very soon, because we see now, sadly, that it's not safe for asylum seekers to be on the streets. And it's worrying now to read reports that there may be a wave of further anti-immigrant demonstrations following on from Friday's incidents in Dublin. And it's really worrying. And as I said, it's not representative of very many people in this country to be acting in this way. The far right are organising these protests. There's a small number of individuals doing it. It's quite well known who they are in many cases. They're targeting homeless international protection applicants. We see now that they're not concerned about housing. They're not concerned about protecting anybody. They're intent on targeting vulnerable people and inciting violence.
Okay, how do we stamp out this kind of racism, John? Like, is there any way to go about it? It seems to be quite serious now.
It is quite serious, and it's time, I feel, that the Gardaí took decisive action against the people who were known to be encouraging violence and indeed organised the attacks on Friday night. And in terms of enforcement, you know, there is legislation there to address what's happening at the moment. It needs to be put into effect. We do also have hate crime legislation, which is coming. And while there are, we feel some weaknesses in relation to that proposed legislation, particularly when it comes to addressing anti-migrant hate crimes, we do hope that it strengthens the capacity of the Gardaí to be able to act. But, you know, it's gone past the point now where these violent far-right extremists can be ignored. Action has to be taken to deal with them and to stop the destabilisation. And also, we have to look to the lies and to the misinformation that's been spread through communities as well. Because when communities are living with and have questions and are already stretched, the government should be providing them with proper information, not creating the conditions and the situations where others come with information and incite violence ultimately against people who are innocent in all respects in terms of the difficulties that people are facing.
Absolutely. John, I suppose, like you just said there, you know, there has been problems in certain communities where, you know, international protection applicants have been moved in or are going to be moved in, and people say, you know, we don't have the services here. Our community has been left down. We haven't been looked after, not making it right, anything that happened at the weekend. But you can see how that can stir up a level of anger amongst people who have been maybe crying out for help for a long, long time.
No, indeed, that is very true. But I think the government has quite a bit of work to do here. They need to take responsibility for this. There are three things in my mind that they need to do. First of all, we need to see them communicating more clearly that they're committed to upholding the rights of asylum seekers and international protection applicants, and to emphasise that all of those international protection applicants are here legally in the country, to ensure that everybody understands the benefits of diversity and the importance of ensuring social inclusion for everybody. The second thing that they need to do is to support all of the great work that's been done around the country by community development organisations to ensure successful integration and social inclusion, and to provide the resources to those organisations. And then the other thing that they need to do is to put sustainable plans and measures in place for the reception and the accommodation of international protection applicants, and also for people who are escaping from the war in Ukraine. At the moment, we don't have that. We have still got a crisis management situation where the Department of Children, who have, it has to be said, got officials who have been doing extraordinary work over the last year, finding beds on a week-by-week or night-by-night basis for people, for over 80,000 people. That's not sustainable. We need to see a better plan in terms of the future reception, accommodation and integration of people seeking protection here.
Okay, John Lannan, CEO of Doris. Thanks very much, John, for joining us today.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, of course, the DAF.ie report is out today and it's found that in Kildare, market rents were on average 11.1% higher in the first quarter of this year than a year previously. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Sinn Féin TD for Kildare North, Rita Cronin. Good afternoon, Rita.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe.
Unfortunately, not good news for the residents of Kildare.
No, and I'm sure the residents of Kildare, and particularly North Kildare, don't need to know that. Don't need me to tell them that. The average rent, £1,739, the average rent now for a house in Kildare. And that compares North Kildare and South Kildare. And people living in North Kildare would love the opportunity of paying just £1,700 for rent, because it's twice that in a lot of places here around Selbridge, Leix, Lipmanutz, Kilcock. The rents are just, they've just gone off the scale. And we're not actually just talking about the cost of living here anymore. Like, too many people are actually talking to me about the cost of surviving. I've had two people this morning tell me that they're actually emigrating because they just cannot afford to live in Ireland anymore. We have mortgages, food, heat, light, and all these bills. But the home is the most basic of all of them. It's and it's crucifying people now, the price they're being asked to pay, and then to be also feeling that they're lucky actually to have a roof over their head with the increase in homeless figures. It's dreadful, and the government isn't doing enough. You know, I'm absolutely accusing the government of turning their backs on tenants across North Kildare, because that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's fairly serious now at this stage. Market rents in Dublin's commuter counties, of course, including here, Rita, 10.2% up year on year. 105 homes were available to rent on May 1st in commuter counties. So I suppose even if you can't afford to pay, the likelihood of you actually getting a place is fairly slim. Sinn Féin seem to have all the answers, Rita. What would you do?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you agree with that now, Caoimhe.
I'm not saying I agree. I'm just saying this is what you think.
You know, this is a problem. I remember back in the 2014 local elections, I was preparing my manifesto back in 2013, and I was talking about a looming housing crisis when the government at the time, Fine Gael, were saying that we had too many houses, and I could see this coming. You know, the government, if I hear another government rep saying you can't fix this overnight, we know that. But, you know, if you started trying to fix it when you first stated that you couldn't fix it overnight, we might be somewhere towards doing that. But so, you know, you have to, all the evidence points to the fact that this government doesn't want to solve housing. That's like any person with any bit of intelligence can see that.
Okay, so just to cut in on you there, Rita, why would the government not want to solve housing, though?
Well, because their voters, like if you look at their voters, and in recent polls, you'll see that their voters aren't concerned about the housing crisis. So that's where's the impetus on them to try to solve it? You know, Owen O'Brien has the documents, he has done the research, he's written the book, Caoimhe, about how to solve the housing crisis, and we have to start by building affordable homes for rent as well on public land. That's where we have to start. Not selling public land. Public land is land that is owned by the people. And the government is selling that to private developers for profiteering. And we have to stop that. A home is the most basic thing you can have. You know, the people coming into my office, they're telling me that this housing crisis, we're now reaching humanitarian crisis. There are so many people as well who aren't even counted in the homeless figures. They're camped out with family and friends, or else some are sleeping in their cars. They're cramped in their parents' box rooms. Some families are having to separate, for the husband takes the boys and the mammy takes the girls, and they go to their respective families. That's no way to live your life. These people are putting their lives on hold, and the government is doing absolutely nothing. And the evidence shows, Caoimhe, that the government are doing absolutely nothing to try to solve this.
Just what you're saying there, Rada, about, you know, the women taking the girls and the boys take the husbands taking the boys. Is this happening in Kildare? Because, you know, we hear from the government that Sinn Féin like to create hysteria. And they say they are making progress and, you know, small steps all the time, but that Sinn Féin like to cause commotion.
I think that shows you really how out of touch they are, because, Caoimhe, you can't have people coming into your office visibly upset. I have had men crying in my office because they never thought that it would come to this, that they wouldn't be able to afford to put a roof over their families' heads. And the realisation that they're on their own when that happens to them it would cut into your heart to see that happen in your office.
And on the other side, there's very little.
So for the government to say that Sinn Féin are trying to politicise this, putting a roof over your head is politics. Mm. Politics is about people and policies and making sure that you create the policies that meet the needs of the people. And this government, Fine Gael in particular, have been in government too long and they are completely out of touch. If they think that I enjoy having people in my office upset about the fact that they can't put a roof over their families' heads, they are more callous than I even have imagined them to be.
Government TDs who come on KFM or maybe, you know, across the country will say, well, you know, that people aren't on their own. You can go down to your local authority, walk into Kildare County Council and, you know, they'll sort it out for you, Rada.
Well, you know, Kildare County Council has been, from talking to my colleagues, I know the Kildare County Council are better than most, but Kildare County Council can't magic up homes that don't exist. They can't magic up, you know, the first thing that you're told is to try to find accommodation with family and friends. And, you know yourself, Caoimhe, if your next door neighbour's house burnt down, you would bring them into your home and give them a roof over their head and you'd, you know, while their house was being repaired. But after, you know, a few weeks or after a couple of months, you'd be kind of getting sick of it and you'd be, you know, relationships would fray. You'd be wondering, well, when are they moving out? Because it affects the family who is homeless and it also affects the family who is living in their own home. And that can't go on forever. And that's what people are being asked to do by Kildare County Council first and foremost. Because Kildare County Council, they can't magic up all these places. What they're doing is what a lot of local authorities are doing is they're renting rooms in Airbnb, and it's too expensive. They can't afford to do that long term. So it's you know, the government has to sit down and absolutely, you know, get the solutions for people. And if there was some kind of a plan, where people could see that the government were meeting their targets, people can hold on when they know the end is in sight. But at the moment, people can't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And that's why I've had two people telling me today that they have decided to emigrate. And that's a failure of government.
Mm. Just let's say there's a general election tomorrow. Sinn Féin got in. Like, in the short term, Rada, what could Sinn Féin actually do to solve this housing crisis?
Well, Eoghan Brin has done a lot of work with local authorities. He came down to Kildare County Council there a few months ago and we met with them and he put questions to them. If I asked you to do this, what would you need? So he's compiling all that information so we're ready to hit the ground running if the people decide that they are willing to give Sinn Féin a chance in government. So we're prepared to hit the ground running if we get into government and start, you know, there's an awful lot of backlogs in the planning system as well, that has to be looked at. But he has already gone around to all the local authorities across the 26 counties across the state, told them what he wants to do, said what would you need to do that, and we have to be ready to deliver that and to implement that when we're in government.
Okay, Sinn Féin TD for Kildare North, Rada Cronin. Thanks very much, Rada, for joining us. And do get in touch if you are a renter in Kildare or what your experience is in this county with renting, with landlords, or even with Kildare County Council. We'd love to know. 0833 97 97 97. Now, people who know me and who go to the beach with me know that I love seaweed. I love to put it on my face and, like, squiggle around in it, take it back, maybe put it in the bath because, you know, it has all these great properties. And now I'm finding out that scientists are discovering the incredible health properties of Irish seaweeds to make medicines to combat dangerous superbugs. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Alva McGurran. She's a PhD researcher in marine biology at UCD. Good afternoon, Alva.
Hi, Cuiva. How are you? Thanks so much for having me.
Delighted to have you on, Alva. Tell us about this new research, Alva, and how I suppose it relates to superbugs.
Yeah, so there's been a load of research increasingly in recent years for new antimicrobials or medicines that can kill bacteria, because a lot of bacteria now have become quite resistant to the traditional medicines that we use. And there's a huge area of research now into natural antibacterial or bacteria-killing medicines from plants and also recently from seaweeds, which is found all around us in our seas and oceans and actually contains loads of chemical compounds that can kill a wide variety of bacteria. So it could be a bit of a green solution to the antimicrobial resistance problem.
Wow, it's amazing because I know some farmers, especially along the coasts, would use seaweed, you know, to as fertilizer maybe and throw it down on their land. Like I said there, you know, I've actually been in Sligo in Enniscrone before and I've taken a seaweed bath there and they're very relaxing. And, you know, there's so many creams as well, seaweed creams, different things, and it is so good for you. So now that it actually could be genuine of health benefit and science to back that up, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I think it's kind of always been known anecdotally for probably thousands of years that seaweed's been really good for us and for the land. As you said, lots of farmers in different countries would use it as a fertilizer. And a lot of different cultures, especially in Japanese or Chinese cultures, would use it as kind of a natural medicine. It's really good for your skin, so fair play bringing it from the beach because it's really good for you. And now there's lots more people trying to back that up with scientific data. So it's great that we can kind of prove something that probably our grannies already told us that we knew.
It just goes to show you the Irish mammy and granny always know best.
Yes, she knows best.
Tell us then how it would work. Like, would it be that you'd be able to take like a in the form of, say, an antibiotic the way we have like tablets? Would you be actually taking maybe something that is enriched with seaweed?
It could be, yeah. So part of my PhD research is to try and work out how to get these antibacterial compounds from inside the seaweed and how we could actually use them in a day-to-day setting. They might be a part of an antibiotic, or maybe they could supplement an antibiotic that we are using in medicine, or some other routes could be maybe in household cleaning products, or we could incorporate bits of seaweed into antibacterial hand gel or something like that, which might be kind of a quicker, easier solution to use the antibacterial properties of seaweeds.
Okay, so what you're saying is really what we're using now, many of the superbugs. And you might explain for people who might not know what exactly a superbug is for Alva. But I suppose many of the things now that we use, you're saying they're just not really working because we've built up a resistance to them.
Yeah, so the term superbug refers to a bacteria that is resistant to lots of different medicines. That's actually what MRSA is in hospitals. It's a bacteria that has evolved to not be reactive to medicines anymore. And that's happened slowly over the course of many decades, from about the 1950s up to now, due to lots of different things. Humans are definitely using too much antibiotics, too frequently. If people are using them to treat viruses, for example, they don't do anything for viruses. So that can just deplete all the good bacteria in your gut. So this has been happening over the course of many, many decades. And now scientists are kind of scrambling to find alternative solutions so that we don't have as big a problem into the future.
Okay, well, it would be brilliant if seaweed was the answer to that problem. Can you tell us about the different types of seaweed? Because, you know, you kind of see different ones. Like there's one that's quite green, there's others that are brownish. Yeah. Will that matter?
Yeah, so there's over 10,000 species of seaweed worldwide. And they're really, really variable between each other. There's three main types that are brown, green and red. And even within those types, there can be huge variations in the numbers of antibacterial chemicals that are in them, which can depend on like the season that they're grown in, the particular climate that they're in. Like the seaweeds maybe in Australia or Asia would be very different to the seaweeds that would live in the cooler waters of the Atlantic, for example. So they can be really, really different. And that's actually kind of a problem or a challenge in the scientific community, is to try and kind of standardize the health benefits from particular seaweeds if they are going to be made into a consumer product.
Okay, so this is specifically Irish seaweed that you're looking at.
Yeah, so I'm working with a great company down in Bantry, Bantry Marine Research Station, and they are farming a few different types of Irish seaweed. So I'm working with them to see what we can do with our own local seaweeds and see what's the kind of potential from them, because Ireland produces loads of seaweed, like 40,000 tonnes of it every year, but we're still not using it really to its full potential.
Okay, so I suppose the big question is how soon can we get these things on the market, Alva? People, I'm sure, will be waiting. As soon as possible, yeah. You're a bit away from it, are you?
I will be, yeah. I'm currently in the second year of a four-year PhD, but there's so many groups now that are working on that and so many different companies. I think there's like over 40 seaweed companies now in Ireland, which is great to see. It's really a fast-moving industry. And as you mentioned there, it's still right now in loads of cosmetics and creams. So that kind of area of seaweed research has really accelerated, which is great to see.
Obviously, this is brilliant for, you know, people's health. But the commercial value potentially of this, Alva, would be huge, because anyone who's been to any beach in Ireland will know that there's just it's lying there just to be taken, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think Bord Iiscí Mhaire came out a couple of years ago and it said that only 1% of Irish seaweed is actually used for kind of higher value compounds like cosmetics or pharmaceuticals or something like that. But that actually amounts to over a third of the total market value of Irish seaweed. So there's a real opportunity there to kind of increase the value of our Ireland's marine economy. And again, the potential that we can get out of our own Irish seaweed.
Okay, Alva McGurran, PhD researcher in marine biotechnology at UCD. Thanks very much, Alva, for joining us. And do let me know if you like seaweed, if you've ever cooked with it, if you've ever had a seaweed bath, or maybe creams that you like to use. There are so many different things that it can be used for. 0833 97 97 97. Now, moving on to camping, and research has revealed that the term happy campers really does ring true, as those who camp are generally happier and less anxious than those who don't. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Simon McGrath. He's head of communications at the Camping and Caravanning Club. Good afternoon, Simon.
Hello, Cuiva. How are you?
Well, Simon, it's great to hear that happy campers really is a true term and we can use it.
Yes, and you know what? I'm a big passionate fan of the great outdoors and going camping and caravanning, but I think what this report, the Outjoyment Report, really does is we linked up with Liverpool John Moores University and Sheffield Hallam University. And whereas I can say to you, you know, I love it and I'm passionate about the pastime, what the report actually does is it really evidences, you know, the benefits that you get from going out camping and being on the doorstep of the countryside.
Yeah, 91% of campers say that they find the pastime relaxing. The thing I would like to question, though, Simon, is, like, is camping that fun when it's lashing rain, cold, windy, you know, all of these different variables? Or would you say, like, you have to make the most of it, you can go camping at any time?
Well, I think you do, and I think, you know what, we're used to some bad weather sometimes, but I think it's what you make of it. And quite often, what camping can do, particularly when the weather conditions aren't with you, is it can build resilience. That can help make you, you know, a little bit stronger mentally, and it's still, even in the bad weather, even when it's cold, it still puts you into the countryside where you can get active and do some really fun things. So, yeah, you know, I think people will often sort of look back and say, oh, yeah, didn't it rain that time? But actually, that's part of the fun element of it. You'll look back, you'll be creating memories that you can relate to years later. And that's often the case with children too. And they say, oh, yeah, my parents dragged me around this campsite and that place. But they look back on it fondly. And I think that's an important part of it too.
So this poll was commissioned by yourselves, Simon, and 10,992 people were surveyed. It found that 97% claim that camping leaves them feeling happy. 48% of campers are more likely to feel happy in everyday life compared to just 35% of non-campers. Why do you think that is, Simon?
Well, I think camping, as I sort of mentioned earlier, puts you on the doorstep of the countryside. And what it does is it creates a pathway to actually doing more activities outside. And we know that 98% of our campers take part in outdoor activities. So something like 91% go walking, 39% cycle, and others enjoy things like bird watching, which came up at 26%. So I think it really kind of like gets you connected to nature much more closely. We know that there are really important health and well-being benefits associated with that too. And I think it's just kind of like creates that time where you can sort of get away from the worries and the busyness of home life and just kind of immerse yourself in that kind of countryside setting. And I think it's great to do.
Yeah, the findings also reveals that 44% of campers are likely to be flourishing compared to 31% of those who don't camp, with 93% feeling the benefits of the activity on their health and well-being. And as you said there, Simon, you know, you're kind of on the doorstep to the countryside. Sometimes, like, you kind of wonder, why do people go camping? Because you kind of think it is a lot of hassle. But there's a ritual, I suppose, to camping that you see, you often see campers, they tend to kind of flock together, you know? And they seem to just have a real enjoyment for it. It's nearly like a pastime.
It is, and I think for some people it's a really affordable form of accommodation. But more and more we're seeing more people embrace it as a lifestyle because they want to spend more time outdoors. And maybe if they have families and younger children that they want to introduce them at a nice young age to those benefits. And certainly, you know, when I used to take... My sons are a bit more grown up now, but when we went out as a family camping, it's a great way for that family unit to bond, where you actually, you know, one of the children goes and fetches the water and another one helps you, you know, hammering the tent pegs as you're pitching the tent, and everyone kind of like bonds together and does something for the good of the family, which you don't get quite so much these days just in normal family life. And I think that's really positive. You know, it's one of those nice traditional things that actually we kind of miss a bit if we don't get involved in that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I suppose you're off the grid a little bit too in a campsite. Maybe, you know, you might have the facilities that you can use, you know, at a main station maybe, but in your actual tent, you're not going to have electricity, that kind of thing. So you're really going back to basics, Simon, aren't you?
Well, you are, and it's a really good kind of digital detox as well, if you like. I mean, certainly when my two were younger, they naturally didn't spend as much time, you know, looking at a screen because they couldn't, whether it was a lack of electricity to charge up their phones, or just, you know, no kind of signal. And that's really quite nice, actually, because it means you then spend more time together and, you know, you do some of the simpler things in life, whether it's playing games or going for a nice long country walk or having a bit of fun doing some kayaking or canoeing, that kind of thing. And I think, you know, we kind of sometimes in our busy, fast-paced world, you know, so we lose sight of that. And actually, it's really nice to go back to those sorts of things.
Sometimes, Simon, when I'm talking to my friends or family or whatever, it seems that the campers and the non-campers seem to be in relationships together. And I don't know if you've witnessed this before. So if there's people listening in today, you know, maybe someone saying, oh, well, I'd love to go camping, but my wife doesn't like to go, or I'd love to go camping, but my husband wouldn't like to go, or boyfriend doesn't like to go. What would you say to them? Maybe, you know, three tips on how to maybe persuade, or a couple of tips on how to go camping and make it enjoyable and get the best out of it?
Well, you know, in terms of just giving it a go, I would say, I mean, it's very affordable, but you could always borrow a tent to start with off of friends or family. And if you've got a garden, pitch it. Now, give it a go for one night. It's a really good way to introduce children to sort of, you know, camping and the outdoors, is because, you know, it's a slightly different environment to go to bed, to go to sleep. So maybe pitch in the garden, maybe borrow a tent to start with. But if you're trying to convince somebody else, you know, maybe your partner, your other half, that actually it's a great thing to do, then, you know, keep an eye on the weather, look out for some good weather, because you want to make it a really good experience. And also think about how you would maximize the way to get a really good night's sleep. So think about warmth, think about comfort and light as well. So, you know, making sure that you've got nice insulation from a cold floor, that you've got an appropriate sleeping bag. And then, you know what, just give it a go, I think, you know, and don't look back. Just try to go with a good sense of fun.
Okay. Simon, did your kids enjoy it when you went camping when you were younger?
Absolutely. We had some fantastic times, some really good adventures, and we've camped in lots of different places. We've even been on a lovely motorhome tour of Ireland a few years ago. I've got a lot of family out in County Mayo, and it was really nice to base ourselves over there in a motorhome. We toured a few lovely campsites, one beautiful one on Achill Island where we went bodyboarding, and we also had that opportunity to go and see family as well, which was just perfect for us. And I really hope that my two sons, who are kind of in their early 20s now, take those lessons forward with them and enjoy it in their futures too.
Okay, so Achill Island up there on your top spots in Ireland. Anywhere else that you'd recommend, Simon?
I've just got back from a trip to Mayo, and I always go back there, but I've counted Dublin as well. But, you know, here in the UK, the Snowdonia in Wales is absolutely gorgeous. I love a good mountain. I love a good mountain hike. So I've really enjoyed that. And I've even been to motorhoming in Slovenia as well, which was fantastic. And the Julian Alps there is something to see. So if you've got the chance to spread your wings a bit further, that's a lovely recommendation as well.
Okay, Simon McGrath, Head of Communications at the Camping and Caravanning Club. Thanks very much, Simon, for your time. You never know, maybe some people around Kildare are going camping this summer. And if you are, do let me know. 0833 97 97 97. I have one last text in here. This is in relation to the housing crisis, I think. This woman says, I am not a councillor nor a TD, but 35 years ago I told a TD the problems were only starting, and that, mark my words, it will happen, and it has happened. So all of you who are running around the country, open your eyes. It's plain to see where the trouble is in this country. And that comes in from Anne. Anne, thank you very much for that message. That's all I have time for today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow between 2 and 3.